From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in Nopa.
I'm from Pittsburgh.
I live in Ingleside.
I live in Sausalito.
I live in the East Bay, Hercules, California, USA, planet Earth.
Coming up, will Californians vote to legalize recreational marijuana?
California's marijuana laws are broken right now, and I think that's actually something that both supporters and opponents of this measure can actually agree to.
We'll hear from both sides of the debate. Then a MacArthur genius talks about his work bringing immigrants out of the financial shadows.
And so here's a moment of saying, here, we see you, we recognize you, and here's a credit score.
And two residents of the Mission reflect on changes in their neighborhood.
You got to talk about it to people and have conversations, pláticas, you know.
Starting the conversation today on Cross Currents. Stay with us. Medical marijuana has been legal in California since the late 90s, but this year, recreational use is up for vote. Proposition 64, known as the Adult Use of Marijuana Act, would allow adults over 21 to possess 1 ounce of marijuana and would establish laws to regulate and tax marijuana cultivation and sales. Proponents say it would curb wasteful spending and provide much-needed revenue for the state. Opponents say more legalization would jeopardize public health. Reporter J.C. Howard has the story.
Well, I think California's marijuana laws are broken right now, and I think that's actually something that both supporters and opponents of this measure can actually agree to.
That's Tenoch Flores, Northern California spokesperson for the Yes on 64 campaign.
The system isn't working, and Prop 64 is actually the best opportunity that we have to reform California's broken marijuana laws.
Flores says under the current laws, there are over 8,000 marijuana arrests in California each year. One of the potential benefits of this measure would be to decriminalize the use and possession of marijuana, especially in minority communities.
In California, over the last 10 years, there have been more than 400,000 felony and misdemeanor arrests for marijuana possession. Blacks and Latinos far more likely to be arrested on a marijuana charge. That shows that the application of marijuana laws in California is unjust.
Flores also says the current system is wasteful.
A lot of law enforcement resources right now are being spent unnecessarily on minor drug offenses, and that needs to change.
For proponents like Flores, Prop 64 is a long time coming. This marks the third time legalization has been on the ballot in California. It was defeated handily in 1972 and lost, by a much slimmer margin, in 2010. Medical marijuana use, however, became legal in 1996, and even some Prop 64 opponents are not totally against its use.
So we don't oppose the medical use of marijuana. What we do oppose, of course, is the improper use of medical marijuana.
Sunnyvale City Councilperson Jim Davis is a No on 64 advocate. He served on the Sunnyvale Police Force for more than 30 years and belongs to the California Narcotics Officers Association.
So I saw a lot of the deleterious effects of marijuana and its use on people and how it can be misused.
He says because marijuana is a nervous system depressant, like alcohol,
it lowers your inhibitions and creates a feeling of euphoria. And what I've seen, especially in chronic users of marijuana, is they lack the ambition, you know, to get up and do things. You know, they lose interest in cleanliness, they lose interest in working, they lose interest in doing things that are safe for themselves.
So Davis is concerned about the drug being used at all. He hears the yes side's argument, but he says the benefits of decriminalization are overstated.
The state of California basically decriminalized the personal possession of marijuana some time ago.
He says since 2010, a small amount of marijuana doesn't lead to jail time.
People who were going to jail and into our state prison system were people who had bricks of marijuana, large quantities of marijuana.
Davis says he suspects a major motivation of Prop 64 supporters is financial.
The reason to approve the sale of marijuana is because we want to make money. I think that that's a really sad reason why anybody would want to support the marijuana initiative.
Supporter Tenoch Flores says, yes, legalization will generate up to $1 billion in revenue.
And that's coming from the state of California's legislative analyst office, okay, an independent body. There would be money up to $125 million a year for law enforcement, $350 million a year for youth substance abuse and prevention programs.
Despite claims that the measure would protect children, opponents have real concerns about minors being exposed to marijuana. Those concerns became even more real this summer, when gummy candies that tested positive for THC, the active ingredient in marijuana, were suspected of hospitalizing people attending a quinceañera party in San Francisco.
19 people, including children as young as 6, ate the candy at the party inside the women's building in the Mission District. All experienced similar symptoms: rapid heart rate, high blood pressure, dilated pupils, dizziness, nausea, and confusion.
Flores responds,
"Well, it's important to note that the incident you cited took place now under the current system."
He says California's learned from Washington and Colorado, where recreational marijuana has been legal since 2012.
Colorado, for example, was a state that had a lot of issues with edibles. So this measure has taken care to use those lessons and apply them in this measure here. So it'll require that all edibles be marked, clearly marked, not marketed to children, be packaged in childproof packaging. And that's something that this measure took great pains to ensure.
Flores says Prop 64 is about allowing adults to use marijuana, not children.
Right now, it's actually easier for minors to purchase marijuana than it is for them to get their hands on alcohol. And the reason for that is that dealers don't check ID. Okay, they're not carding people as they make these purchases. That needs to change, obviously, and that will change as a result of this measure. This measure restricts marijuana use, marijuana purchases, to adults 21 and up, just like alcohol sales.
Statewide measures for marijuana legalization are on the ballots in 4 other states this year: Arizona, Maine, Massachusetts, and Nevada. But even if Prop 64 or those other states' measures pass, the Federal Drug Enforcement Administration has announced that marijuana will remain a Schedule I substance, and users would officially be in violation of federal law. For Cross Currents, I'm J.C. Howard.
If you're overwhelmed by this year's 17 statewide propositions, don't worry, we've got your back. Head to our website, kalw.org, to find all sorts of election coverage to keep you informed. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. This fall, the MacArthur Foundation announced its annual list of fellowship awards, often known as the Genius Awards. And one of this year's winners is San Francisco-based Jose Quinones. He's founder of the Mission Asset Fund. It's a nonprofit focused on giving immigrants and low-income communities a chance to be visible in the financial market. He says at least 64 million Americans don't have credit scores, and 17 million don't have access to bank accounts. And you need those to be able to buy a car or rent a home, or in some cases, even find a job. So Quinones went back to what immigrant communities do have, the social monetary systems from back home, and he applied them here. How does it all work? Quinones joined me in studio to explain.
And so one of the things that is very common in immigrant communities is people coming together and lending and saving money together. This is a practice that is, you know, that is common the world over. In Mexico, they call them tandas, condinas, they call them susus throughout the Caribbean.
In Sudan, they're called sanduk, which is like a box.
Right, sanduk, right there.
Sanduk.
Yeah, I love that. I love that. And I love, you know, always learning new names for this thing. But the activity is exactly the same thing, which is a group of 5, 10, 15, 20 people, 30 people come together, and they all agree on doing something, which is putting some money on the table. Or more money in a box or money in a pool, and then they, you know, each of the members, and then they take turns in taking the money out. So imagine a group of 10 people each putting $100, then all of a sudden you come up with $1,000, and then somebody takes $1,000, and then the next month everybody again puts in $100, and then you generate another $1,000, and then the second person gets that. And so they do that in rotation until everybody gets a chance of getting $1,000. So this activity is common, it's been happening throughout millennia across the world. Why? Because when people have no access to, you know, formal financial systems, they create their own. You know, they, why? You know, because they need to, you know, mechanisms of saving and borrowing together. And they do that with their sheer, you know, trust, the relationships that people have, the bonds, the social capital that comes by being part of a community. And so people that are, you know, friends, colleagues, co-workers, family members, they're the ones that are usually sort of formed as lending circles. So we sort of recognize that activity as being beautiful, as being awesome, as being like, you know, I mean, just the thing, just imagining the poor people coming together to lending and saving money together, it's just something that it's, you know, that we should all be paying attention. And so what we did was recognize that. And then we also recognized that actually that the activity that happens within those circles is actually very much the same as the activities that we do within our own banks or credit cards, where we borrow money and then we pay them back. The activity of paying back is what we recognize as being very similar. So instead of putting these lending circles as some sort of, you know, exotic, you know, different way that people do things, it's more like it's actually very same, which is people are borrowing money and paying that back. But when we borrow money from the bank, that gets recorded and reported to the credit bureaus. And that activity gets, you know, there's a record of it. And then that record actually helps build and improve people's credit, you know, FICO scores or credit scores.
You need credit for everything.
Yeah, and exactly. Mm-hmm. But the activity of people paying into a lending circle, an informal lending circle, does not get recorded or reported. That activity sort of vanishes afterward. Mm-hmm. So we found a way of saying, well, actually, if we can help formalize that activity by having people sign a promissory note, that promissory note then becomes that document that transforms that activity from being informal to being formal. Is that document that our financial systems can actually recognize and validate, and is the document that then gives MAF the position of being able to sort of service those loans and then report that activity to the credit bureaus.
And so then, how does that affect the members of the lending circle?
We've managed close to $7 million worth of lending, you know, lending circles. Our default rate is like 0.7%. I mean, the industry standard in the microlending world, just to kind of give you context to that, is more like 12 to 14%. And so people really are committed, you know, to the program, to paying back. And then we, in terms of impact, we actually see a tremendous increase in people's credit scores. On average, the credit scores go up by like 168 points. Mm-hmm. About 30% of our clients start with zero, and they go from zero to 600, you know, in a span of 10 months. So it's really significant. I mean, we've had clients come to our office, you know, for the first time, you know, they see it, they have a credit score, and some of them get emotional, teary-eyed, because it's a moment of recognition. This is where, like, the system recognizes who they are and what they're here for. And again, these are folks that, you know, live in the shadows, that struggle, you know, in life in the shadows. And so here's a moment of saying, here, we see you, we recognize you, and here's a credit score. You know, and it's truly transformative in their lives. So it's truly impactful, and we're definitely, you know, expanding the program across the country, you know, with more communities to work with them.
You are so invested in this work. You mentioned people coming up teary-eyed, say, you know, with feeling the financial system sees them and recognizes them. You have been recognized now with this MacArthur Award. What does this mean for you personally?
It's a life-changing event, honestly. I mean, I've been very comfortable, you know, throughout my life. You know, I lived in the shadows. I was, you know, amongst the 11 million people that were undocumented. You know, so I know what that's like. And to some extent, you know, I found freedom in being in the periphery, you know, being in the periphery of society. There's a little bit of freedom to innovate, to fail, to succeed in different ways. But this award just thrusted me in the middle of everything. And so I'm struggling with that, frankly. But I know that this is a good thing, you know, because at the end of the day, what in our core message, what we're trying to say is that, you know, there's a lot of good in our community. You know, the immigrants of America, we're making America better. You know, and I know that in the future of America is brighter because of what we bring to the table, how we are going to contribute to society. And so I know it's a good thing, but I'm still wrapping my mind around that, but and trying to understand the responsibility that comes with this designation, so that, you know, in the rest of my life, the rest of my career, I can, you know, I can live up to that, but also make sure that we're moving the conversation forward so that you know, America as a country, as a society, will be much better for, you know, for our work.
That was Jose Quiñones, founder of the Mission Asset Fund. He's a winner of this year's MacArthur Foundation grant. Find more about his work, including how to start your own lending circle, at kalw.org. Click Cross Currents. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hanat Baba. The Mission District's history as a landing place and home base for San Francisco's Latin American communities has been shifting over the past decade. Displacement of longtime residents is a contentious issue. Roberto Hernandez is a leader of Our Mission No Eviction campaign, and he's given these issues a lot of thought. In this piece from San Francisco StoryCorps, Hernandez speaks with young Mission District local Akia Muster about the changes they've seen in their neighborhood.
My whole life took place here in the Mission, you know. My grandpa worked at SF General for 45 years. The reason why he loved living here and walking on 24th Street was because it reminded him of growing up as a kid in Nicaragua. People would say hi to you. You know, you get a little pan dulce. And I had that as a kid, kind of, when I would walk with him everywhere we go. I think, in a way, they've already taken over the Mission. And it's not about race. To be racist, it's not anything like that. It really is, I believe, a white thing.
They don't talk to you, they don't acknowledge you. And it's funny because, you know, on my block, we've had, you know, 7 families that have been evicted. And on my block, every time somebody got evicted, every time somebody moved in, I'd go in and introduce myself, right? And tell them I'm the captain of the block and I watch out for everybody on the block. And they look at me like I'm crazy, you know? If it was a Latino family that moved in, right, I welcomed them and they invite me in. You know what I'm saying? All 7 white folks that moved into the block, not one has invited me inside their home. That's a difference. It's a cultural thing.
Yeah. You understand that, what a neighborhood means when it's your only neighborhood, when it's the only place you can speak Spanish to somebody in a little tienda. And I think they don't understand that when they come in. They don't understand the privilege of being able to see white people no matter where you go, in positions of power, positions of influence. And the only place that that exists for us in the city is in the Mission, that you see people, business owners that are Latino, or supervisors like David Campos or John Avalos, that they're Latino. And to see that we're together and they come in here and they disrespect that, and it's like they're peeing on it. Like, they don't care. They don't acknowledge the fact that we are a people here. It just makes me really mad and sad, you know.
I learned this from Cesar Chavez because I was an organizer for him. I remember getting angry, and he would say, you know what, you got to take that anger and you got to use that anger to cause change. And you got to talk about it to people and have conversations, pláticas, you know. So that's what I've been doing. I've just been talking to every time I see somebody new that's not involved, say, hey, brother, did you hear? I know you know about these evictions. What are you going to do about it? How are you going to get involved?
That story was produced by Truk Nguyen and facilitated by Sophia Simon Ortiz. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba, and we'll stay in the San Francisco StoryCorps booth for our next piece. Ellen Tenway was in her 50s when she began attending church, looking for answers to life's tough questions. Susie Indo happened to be the pastor at that church. The two women met, became friends, and then much more. They sat down at the San Francisco StoryCorps booth to talk about reconciling their love for one another with their faith in God.
My name is Ellen Tenway, and my relationship to the person sitting across from me is she is my partner.
And I am the person sitting across from you, Ellen. My name is Susie Indo, and my relationship to Ellen is she's the love of my life. We've known each other for
over a decade.
Yeah, probably 12
years. 12 years, yeah.
I first met you because I was looking for faith because my mom was sick. That's when we went to church.
Where I was the pastor.
Where you were the pastor, and mm-hmm. That's where we first met.
Yeah.
You being a pastor, I remember I asked you, where in the Bible does it say that it's wrong to be gay?
And what did I say?
You didn't say anything.
I didn't want to answer you.
But did you have an answer?
So I always had this, like, opposite, you know, what I felt and what was wrong. And I always was, like, clashing within myself. So that's why I didn't answer your question.
I was going to be leaving, and we were standing by your door and looking at your face with your just eyes closed and, like, breath held and like and then after you kissed me, then it was like
excuse me, you
no, you kissed me,
kissed
you kissed me,
me. My heart changed. All of my friends were very conservative, and they don't believe in homosexuality.
My family having a pretty well-known name is a big deal, and I didn't want to cause them embarrassment and everything. We had so many discussions about the Bible, where we would sit for hours and hours
and
just
I'd tell
talk.
You Bible stories. And,
yeah.
Yeah, we'd talk about faith and
right.
Yeah, belief.
But then even just coming to the Ten Commandments and the laws and about people pointing fingers about, you know, you're, you know, it's wrong, the sin, and yet it's like, well, why can they pick and choose what sin to preach about or to scold people about?
For me, untangling who I am and how God loves me, and then trying to figure out, well, God loves me what? As a queer woman? Oh, my gosh. So that took, like, well, basically 4 years to figure out, no, God still really loves me just as I am. God made me like this. He doesn't create junk. God made me like this.
As my understanding grew and my love that developed with you, and what I found out was really what true love is.
Which is what we really have, is true love.
Right.
Oh my gosh.
Is
we would have missed it if you didn't kiss me.
You kissed me. But it's the faith, hope, and love.
And the greatest,
and the
of, these
greatest
is love.
Of these is love.
Absolutely. God is God, and God is God of everything and everybody. So whatever form, whatever way love is expressed, that's God.
Those were partners Ellen Tenway and Susie Indo speaking in San Francisco's StoryCorps booth. That story was produced by Lisa Cantrell. If you want to interview a loved one for StoryCorps at the San Francisco Public Library, we'll show you how to make an online reservation. Go to kalw.org and click Cross Currents. And that's our show for today. Our team includes Jürgen Klemm, Leela Day, Angela Johnston, Olivia Henry, Jeremy Jew, Ted Muldoon, Lisa Morehouse, James Rollins, Judy Silbert, Stephen Short, Carrie Spivak, and Andrew Stelzer. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Managing producer is Julie Kane. Ben Trefney is our news director. Today's show was engineered by Chris Hoff, and the line producer was Hannah Kingsley Ma. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. Today's local music is from Windy Hill, a traditional bluegrass band from Portola Valley. Windy Hill play at the Plow and Stars on Clement Street in San Francisco Saturday night. Show starts at 9 o'clock. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.